This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Today, we'll visit with a young pianist who is, in a word, inspirational, Tanya Gabrielian. Growing up in California, her musical gifts on numerous instruments were recognized early, though she had no great drive to be a musician, instead preferring sciences, bioengineering, and physical activity, such as martial arts. It was while practicing that activity that she severely injured her back while trying to protect her piano-playing hands. This time that she spent in recuperation changed her life over to music and gave her a new perspective and passion to bring great music to those who may never have a chance or be given the opportunity to hear it. She performs special programs and projects that bring music of past centuries closer to our time, giving them relevance. And she continues to give performances in conjunction with NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Health. In fact, she'll be performing in our area tomorrow evening at the Trenton Psychiatric Hospital and at a NAMI workshop conference on Saturday. And finally, a concert the public can attend at a benefit for NAMI of Mercer County at the Pennington School on Sunday. I'll give details at the end of our chat. Her new CD of Bach transcriptions called Remix on the MSR Classics label finds her performing music of the composer that was her solace during her time in recovery. These are transcriptions of works Bach composed for other instruments. You're listening to the final moments from the famous Chaconne from the solo violin Partita No. 2 in D minor BWV 1004. This transcription by the late 19th, early 20th century Russian pianist Alexander Silotti. I spoke with Tanya Gabrielian up in New York City last week. Here today with the pianist Tanya Gabrielian. Congratulations on the CD. Now, the CD is all Bach, but not source keyboard works of Bach, rather works Bach composed featuring or for solo instrument other than the keyboard, and these are transcriptions of those works for piano, which leads us right off the bat to two questions, two dynamics of the disc. Why record these instead of keyboard works of Bach? What was the decision making in that?
That's a good question. Because he didn't write enough notes in the keyboard works? No, I'm kidding.
No.
Well, I played these pieces on their original instruments, all of them. Mm-hmm. So I started the violin when I was 4, and I also switched to viola when I went to college. So I did my undergrad also on viola. So the second cello suite was actually the first cello suite that I played on the viola. And all the violin works on there, I also play on the original instrument. So for me, these are always the Bach works that spoke the deepest to me.
Right.
And this also leads to sort of when I was listening to a lot of Bach,
right,
when I was hospitalized when I was 18, 19,
yeah, we'll get to that,
from an accident. But right, Bach has always been a very strong part of my musical identity. It's a composer that has appeal, I think, across all genres. I mean, if you ask anybody about Bach, they know him, they find beauty in his works. And I think it's very relatable that, you know, hundreds of years later, it's so relevant. It's so romantic in ways. It's so modern. It's got so many facets to your personality that you can show.
Yeah, it's interesting in the Chaconne with any keyboard arrangement. It's not that violinists written for solo violin can't play it cleanly, but you hear everything so much more cleanly.
It's a totally different
thing. It is a totally different case.
I mean, I also firmly believe that Bach would be fine with these transcriptions. I mean, we have this image of Bach as sort of a, you know, powdered wig and a, you know, this, you know, stodgy image of the paintings that we have. But I think he was quite a hot-blooded man.
Yeah.
I mean, he had 19 kids. That's got to tell you something about his character.
Yeah.
I mean, but also, I mean, he almost got into a duel with somebody.
He
was thrown in jail for other reasons.
Yeah.
But I mean, he did spend a month
for being stubborn and high. taking sides.
But, you know, he called a, you know, the bassoon a billy goat, and they almost drew swords over that. And he also wrote a lot of his works for other instruments.
Right.
So he recomposed the piano concerto, or also done on with his arrangements, and there are stories of him actually playing the violin sonatas on the keyboard. So I don't think it's any feat that, you know, we will take advantage of this music, which works on any instrument essentially, because at its core it's so meaningful. And I don't think he would have, you know, been opposed to also using the piano when you play a keyboard work by Bach. I've done a fair amount on harpsichord just to see what it's like and get the sense of how sort of more stylistically relevant
right
to what you know, will be around then. And when you play Bach on a harpsichord, it's a very different feeling than playing Bach on a piano. So you're already transcribing the piece for a new instrument. So it's just one step further to take a piece that wasn't originally for piano, and that's written specifically for the piano. So it really does take advantage of the qualities that the piano has that other instruments don't.
Yeah, and we should say the transcribers here, the Siloti, the Garofsky, but what's fun is the violin sonata has four different...
Right.
There's four movements, three different.
Three different composers.
Three different transcribers. Yeah. The first one is Bach.
And that's, that shows you that he was thinking of these pieces in more than one way. The original one is in G major, and I transpose it to C major just to match the other movements. I mean, and also the fact that he did it in a different key.
Right.
Back then, you know, each key had a very different meaning because of the tuning and sort of the temperament of the instrument. So that would have also been another color. So I don't think he would have been upset that, you know, I'm playing his music in this way, in a new fashion.
Once again from my guest, Tanya Gabrielian's new CD on the MSR Classics label called Remix, Bach Transcriptions. Here's the first movement from the Violin Sonata No. 3 in C major, BWV 1005. The other three movements are transcribed by other composers, but this one is by the master himself. Thank you.
the second point on the music, you already kind of answered. There is this other dynamic of why you chose these pieces. They have meaning to you, not only from a time that was pretty tough for you, but even going back to your childhood, playing different instruments. Mm-hmm. You're playing piano by the age you were three. However, with all that musical background, you wanted to do a career in science.
Yes.
Bioengineering, other than music, which is, I guess, is nice because you could talk to listeners who think that they can't have a career in music if they get too old. Oh, it's a, like, start as a kid.
Can anyone have a career in music? That's another interview.
That's another thing. Let's not crush their dreams quite. So, tell the story of why you wanted to go in a completely different direction, and then what kind of sucked you back, drew you back.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, we all have very different personality types, and I don't think right off the bat, I never had this calling to be a musician. I'm so jealous when there are people that feel this strong identity that their lives were here to become a musician and to relay this music that means so much to them and bring it to audiences. And that's something that for me was never a feeling that I identified with from a young age. You know, when you start at the age of three, I don't know if I even knew what music was. Right. At that point, it's just something that you do because you're told to do. And, I think it's something that a lot of people are just put in for, not at their own insistence, but at their parents' insistence. Right. And I think this is also a sort of a path that a lot of musicians come to from. That's how they start. And music is, unfortunately, a field where if you don't start young, you're at a disadvantage. So when I was playing as a kid, I didn't think about it. I didn't think twice about it. I never listened to music so much that it moved me to tears or anything like that. And you just sort of do it. And then when it came time to finishing high school, academics were very important to me. And I feel that I've always sort of identified with the sciences. That's the way my brain works. I think I'm very analytical. As a musician, I don't like this bohemian lifestyle one bit. Right. I'm very highly organized and scheduled, and I like everything just so. And, every personality test I've done says I should go in engineering. And, and I think that's true in that sense. But I was tired of doing both music and academics. And it's weird that I have to make that separation between the two, but it was very different because, unfortunately, in public schools, music is not part of our curriculum. So when it came time to finishing, I took a year off. I was going to go to Harvard for biomedical engineering, and I moved to London to study for a year at the Royal Academy, and I hated it. I absolutely hated it. It was a sort of a commuter school. I mean, there was no dorm. There was no sense.
The encouraging part is coming in the story.
It is.
So far, it's a real downer.
I mean, and also in England, when you study music, it's a very different system there. For going into college, you identify your major right away.
Right.
So you don't take any other subjects. And I was so used to, I had a calculus book that I would just do for fun, just to keep my brain moving, which is absurd at this point. And I remember asking the school if I could take math courses. And they were like, why? Why would you do this? We've never had this request before. And so it was a very surreal sort of place. And also people coming from the background of just being in music school from the age of, eight,
right,
that don't know anything else, that, don't really talk about anything else. And also just the lack of community amongst the other musicians because, we don't live together. Nobody really knew each other. And it was very isolating and in a new country and all blah, 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 all that kind of stuff,
Right.
So I started doing Kung Fu.
Right.
And that's sort of how I found people that I could relate to. It was always something that I wanted to do from a young age, but my parents never let me do. And so, the second I left home, I was like, I'm going to do Kung Fu. And I was quite serious about it.
Before you get too far, at some point you had to decide on piano. You said you played on these other
instruments. Oh, right. Yeah, no,
I was
much better at piano than violin.
Okay.
It wasn't even... I liked violin more in the sense that it was a more social instrument.
Right.
I was in orchestra. Chamber music on strings instruments is very different. And also just the simplicity of one line versus the whole harmony and everything. You're sort of a self-contained unit as a pianist, which is probably why I've chosen it in the long run. But when you're part of a team as a string player, that's also a very different sense of identity that I think is a more healthy lifestyle, shall I say.
Right.
But I was always better at piano than string instruments, so.
Did you have to, were your parents at all in this, or your guardians? With the fact that you were going to switch over to music? I mean, were they cheering for one side or the other? They didn't care. They just wanted you to do what you wanted to do.
Just keep me out of jail, so that works,
okay. Yeah.
Here's my guest, pianist Tanya Gabrielian, performing another transcription, this a total Russian affair, Miri Balakirev's piano arrangement of Mikhail Glinka's song, The Lark.
So you're a pianist.
Yes.
But you're also doing this all other stuff, including the kung fu. But as a pianist, of course, the number one thing is to protect the
protect kamadi, your hands.
Protect the kamadi.
Yes.
Well, you can pick it up from there.
Right. Well, so we would practice in a sort of an unsanctioned place. It was just a sort of a meeting room in the student union. So it wasn't a gym. We didn't have proper mats or anything, which is, you know, not a great idea.
Right.
But, you know, when you're that age, you don't have the fear.
Right.
And so I was sparring with somebody, and because the floor was hard, the sweat was collecting on the floor. And I just remember sparring with him thinking, you know, he's moving very strangely and something's a little off. And I kicked his head, and my other leg was on the floor still, and I slipped on some sweat. And I fell forward, and I just remember thinking, I have a concert next week. I have to not hurt my hands. So I pulled my hands back, and I fell on my head. So, yeah, there was a shock in the room. You don't think about it when you're in that situation, but it goes slow motion, and it's not painful. I just fell on my head. And so everybody was rushing around, you know, the blood was there, and my hands were just fine, so I grabbed my nose. I just looked like a beast, but my hands were great. And they took me to the emergency room, and they classified me as broken bones rather than a head injury. So it was obvious, they didn't even bother taking an x-ray of my face, it was obviously broken. They told me, you know, wait a couple days and go into a different hospital to make the appointment to get your bones put back. So I went home, then a couple days later I started shaking. It started out slower, then it became fairly uncontrollable. There was just these tics. Basically, my diaphragm would tense up, and I would just be, you know, shaking. I mean, it was a great ab workout, but I wouldn't recommend it. So I was admitted into hospital on my 19th birthday, and this was in England, so I didn't have any family there. The system is different there for medical care, good and bad. So they put me on an orthopedic ward instead of a neurological ward, and then the surgery for the broken bones was at a different hospital, so I missed that. Anyway, it took a month, basically, before I got the proper care that I needed. I was finally admitted to a neurological ward. They determined I had damaged spinal fluid, and I was shaking just pretty much uncontrollably for that whole time. They put me on medication for the next few years, and that's that.
Well, just on that, so the recovery time before you could resume piano career was how long?
Oh, I had to cancel a bunch of things. So I was in a hospital for about a month. Two main hospitals I stayed at. I went to 9 different hospitals in total for all of the exams and work. I had 2 operations. And the system is very different there. So you are basically in a ward. The ward that I stayed in the hospital for the longest was, I think, 24 people in the room. And it was a medical ward rather than a surgical ward. So it was people there with serious injuries, I mean illnesses, not injuries. And I was by far the healthiest person there. So it gives you this very much perspective on, you know, how lucky you are to have what you have. And, you know, it's sad that we can't be grateful for things until they're sort of taken away from us. But this was a very reflective time in my life. And then I had a lot of time also, because this is the first time in my life that I ever stopped playing piano. I don't think I'd ever even taken maybe more than a day off from playing. It was just so regularly part of my day-to-day schedule that you don't even, it's like breathing, it's brushing your teeth. Like, what would happen if you don't brush your teeth for a week? You would then realize it, but you don't think about it as something on a different way before then. So I just remember missing the piano, perhaps what it was for just regularity in my life again or whatnot. And then I had just all this time laying there in bed with nothing to do. So I had a CD player with me and some books. And part of the CDs that I had were these Bach suites, the solo violin sonatas and partitas, and then the cello suites. And out of the time, I think it's the Bach that spoke to me the most. And it was also a time where, you know, that really sort of takes you away from your existence, that you then really do see, oh, hey, music does transport you. It does make you feel better in this way that I just never even thought twice about, because it was such a regular part of my life. So when that's forcibly taken away from you, then you get a very different impression of what it can mean for people.
You've said things like, this might seem strange to our listeners, but it made you a listener.
Yes.
Like an audience member.
It's weird to have to make that distinction, yeah. But you just don't even consider it before that point. I never did.
Huh. And when you came out on the other side of this, mm-hmm. you're healthy, you're playing, this drastically changed your career, your focus in your career.
Yes, I decided to go into music, essentially, from this experience.
Yeah. But also just what your focus would be as you went. You know, you had done some competitions, you'd done all this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. but you wanted to focus on how music interacts with people's lives in different ways than just showing up, performing, going to another studio, showing up, performing. I mean, just...
And that's something that I've sort of carried on the rest of my career, is that music can, from my perspective, from the performer's perspective, can be a very self-motivated pursuit, that you're very much on stage under the spotlight, you're showing facets of your personality and performances, but how is that connecting to an audience? I mean, when you go play for people, you come and go, you don't really interact with them, so you can't see if the music moves them or how it would affect them later on, or really have much impact in the community other than that, you know, the 90 minutes that you're on stage. So when you become a listener, then you get a very different sense on what music can do for you in that sense, so that you feel like it's not just about you. You feel it's about something greater than that. I mean, that's why I wanted to go in the medical field initially, is because I wanted to help people, you know, on a very basic level of medically getting them better. I'm scared of blood, so I would, you know, we go into actual medicine if it weren't for that. But, you know, in a way, music can also just heal your brain in terms of making you feel better for being here, and that in its core is the whole point of this.
My guest pianist Tani Gabrielian's new CD remix, Bach Transcriptions, features Leopold Godofsky's version of Bach's solo cello suite number 2 in D minor, which my guest played on cello as a child. Here's the concluding gigue.
Some specifics of what you're doing, but just musically, were you playing differently? I mean, was there a change in how you interpreted the music you were playing from before and after the accident?
I don't know. I would think so. I think everything that affects us as a human being reflects in how we play. I mean, I was also just 18, 19 at the time, so I don't think I was, you know, a fully complete human being then, nor am I now. So, you know, I would hope that my playing will continue to evolve as I get older, but I don't know the specifics, but I certainly hope it did change the way I play.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, some of the audience might be wondering, well, what does this mean? We talk about why, too, in some of these, but because I think some of the things you're doing, you're not unique in doing it, but I think it, for better or for worse, it kind of sets apart some musicians who are really in of our time, of the 21st century. Mm-hmm. There's different focus, different, you know, rather than maybe 20, 30, even 40 years ago, what career path was, what you got out of it, mm-hmm. what your goals were, whether it was getting that record label contract, whether it was, you know, concertizing around the world in the great halls of management. Things have changed a lot. So there is a lot of focus back on what music and bringing music to diverse audiences. This has been a big deal.
That's really important to me, is that because having experienced sort of repose from music, you know, I realize that it can help people. And it can remove you from where you are. And it's also, unfortunately, become a symbol of this elitism. And that's really what's dividing our country and our world at this time, is the separation of the, you know, the 1% from the 99. And it's so sad when you think that music, which is at its core such a communicative tool to express emotions, and how can that be used as something to separate people from others?
Right, because music is...
It's all in. I mean, that's the reason why Bach is still relevant today, is because he had the same desires and wants as we do today.
Right.
As does every single human being. I mean, even psychopaths, you know, want acceptance on some level, probably from themselves, surely. But, you know, and music is so powerful because it brings us all together, because it shows how much we have in common and how we can all identify with these feelings. So to me, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love performing, I love playing in all these halls and stuff.
Sure.
I don't think you can make that separation of the career path in that sense. But also, for me, it's just as meaningful. Young musicians have the separation as, you know, if I'm playing in a library, it's less important than I'm playing on Carnegie Hall stage. And it's not, because you're playing for people. It's
right.
just because those people paid more and are of a different social class.
Right.
So I think it's important to make that distinction, and make, especially classical music, you know, music education also is something that's not in our schools. And classical music is something that you don't really come to unless you have that education. And it's not a part of the American history.
Right.
So why is it relevant? Well, why is Shakespeare relevant? Right. You know, but there's no question about that in schools. We study Shakespeare. So why don't we study Mozart? It, to me, is exactly the same thing.
It is. I mean, the one hurdle of music, which is just ridiculous, but it's a different language.
Yes.
Shakespeare, there are English words that they might not be understood by first, second, second, but it's English words. You know,
yes.
So, I mean, you are one, though, that is and continues to sort of walk the talk. So talk about, like, your work with NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think also part of the reason why I feel so comfortable in these situations is because I've just never felt like a musician at the core. That,
right.
you know, I can easily talk to somebody that's ever heard music about why I think it's important and for what they can listen to without any sort of background of knowledge for that. That I think something that's not taught in conservatories, of how to make it approachable.
Right.
And this whole accessibility issue for me is at the core of this. And so NAMI, it's the National Alliance on Mental Illness. This is a sort of mental health awareness is something that has been very meaningful for me for a long time. My sister's a psychiatrist, and I remember her telling me once about how, you know, if you have cancer, you come out and you say you have cancer, you're getting all the sympathy, get money thrown at you from charities and all that kind of stuff, and mental illness affects more people than cancer.
Yeah.
And it's still something that's very taboo. I mean, it's now becoming something that people talk about more, but when you look at sort of the history of music, it's something that has been covered up for centuries. If we go back to Beethoven, he had bipolar. He was also deaf. So when he was deaf, he wrote all these conversational books with his friends and colleagues about music and his thoughts on life and just everything in general. And when he died, his biographer destroyed 2/3 of them because they portrayed a negative impression of him. So, you know, why are we keeping this hallowed image of him rather than, you know, making him identifiable by the struggle? I mean, I don't know anybody that's alive that can say they haven't had a difficult life
right.
for some reason or another. And that's what's connecting us. You know, Schumann, for example, bipolar, also tried to commit suicide 3 times.
Yeah.
And the last 2 years of his life was in a mental institution. His wife and Brahms destroyed some of his works because it was tainted by his madness.
Right.
You know, why? What is that? Mm. And then there's also, at the same time, there's this terrible cliche that music comes from tragedy. and artists are tortured souls, which is, to me, the absolute opposite of what it should be. So, I mean, when you think about any movie to do with piano or the arts, like Black Swan or The Pianist or The Piano Teacher or all these movies and, you know, anything in pop culture, they have a very twisted impression of what the artist goes through. Now, I'm not saying that it's not, you know, relevant on many cases, but what I'm trying to do is show that everybody can contribute beauty to this world regardless of their personal circumstances.
And you even perform and have, you know, through some of these projects, done recitals of simply composers who struggled with some form of mental illness.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important just to also say the good and bad things about what they were going through, because that's what made them who they were. And also, what's interesting for me is that I've done a lot of things at mental hospitals. And when you play for people in these situations, they're not expecting anything from you. It's not like a concert stage, normal stage, where people are expecting a certain thing. And when you also, when you're in hospital, having been in hospital, it's pretty much one of the worst times of your life. So if there's something that you can do to, you know, allow them to step away from their situation at the time, even if it's just for a moment, that's a beautiful thing you can do. And also, I just remember once playing, I started a series at a hospital on Upper Manhattan, the New York State Psychiatric Institute, and that's actually where Rachmaninoff stayed, and he donated a piano to them. But I was playing, I think, maybe it was some Schumann, and I was talking about him. I was like, he had bipolar, and then, you know, some guy in the audience raises his hand and says, oh, I have bipolar too. And so you can see yourself in these pieces. And, you know, there's that connection that people don't have to classical music, is that how does this relevant to me today?
Right.
Why is the stuff written when people were wearing powdered wigs and didn't have electricity? How is that relevant to me today?
It's something like Rachmaninoff. I mean, you talk about the bipolar, Schumann trying to commit suicide, but even just down to Rachmaninoff, it's simply just depression, probably the most pervasive mental condition there is. It's just simply suffering from just really bad depression,
and,
you know, which kept him from writing therapy, getting out of it, and,
right,
and all
right.
this kind of stuff.
Right.
So, yeah.
Music of Sergei Rachmaninoff, the final minutes from the final movement of his Piano Sonata No. 1, as performed by my guest today, Tanya Gabrielian.
Sort of dovetailing out of that work are some of these projects you've done, correct? I don't know if you want to mention some of them, but, you know, whether it's improvisation, whether it has to do with thematic things like war,
well, I mean,
and all that.
I started also thinking about just the format of a concert and the role of a classical musician in particular, because as an artist, you're creating something new, and as a classical musician, you are recreating something. So how much of yourself can you put into that? In terms of, I mean, you have to respect the composer for what they've written and sort of their own impressions of what they were trying to accomplish, and you can't put too much of yourself that it becomes purely a sort of a self-motivated, you know, spiel on how you're feeling rather than what the composer intended. So I think you do have to respect that. And also just the concert format in itself of having pieces that don't really have any connection to each other, but just to have contrasts, and what's the continuous trend through the whole program? How do we keep an audience engaged through the whole thing? And how do we then get a specific point of view through that experience? So these are things that really mean a lot to me, and I was thinking about this, and the first thing I did was with an artist named Fran Bull, and she had an exhibition called In Flanders Fields, which is based on a poem written during World War I. So it was this whole meditation on war, and so we put from within the exhibition the Messiaen Quartet for the End of Time, which was, of course, written at a prisoner of war camp during World War II. Not novel in sort of that approach, but to have the visual element with the sound and to be in sort of an immersive experience like that, I think also impacts people, you know, because we're in a society where we are constantly bombarded by images and technology, and our attention spans are very different now than they were 100 years ago or 200 years ago when this music was being written. So we need to engage people, you know, on many different levels, and that's also how we bring new people into the audience. So from there, I've done a bunch of other projects. The most recent one was based on final statements of executed death penalty prisoners in Texas. And it was interesting, you know, I remember just looking online one day and finding an art piece about the final meals of death penalty prisoners and sort of a very artistic rendering of that. And then, you know, one click led to another, and I found all of the final statements of the executed prisoners from Texas. And then you start looking at the ethnicity, you start looking at the education level, and there are certain trends that you see that are undeniable. And what can I do about this? I can't change policy. I can only change opinions or just tell people my opinion. So I think it was also very interesting juxtaposition to put this with them. Haydn wrote a piece, The Seven Last Words of Christ on the Cross, which was commissioned for Lent or whatever. I don't know the proper terms.
For Good Friday.
And, you know, Christ, the story is that he died for the sinners, and who more is a sinner than someone on death row?
Right.
And when you read these statements, the word used most in them is love. So you have this, you know, interesting combination of killers who are loving. How do they want to be remembered? What do they want for their final words? But there's just so many parallels you can draw. And then to put that then with the Haydn piece, which is, you know, it's not an angry piece at all. You know, you can't even hypothesize how you would feel in that situation until you are. So it's hopefully a life-affirming piece to just look at the values that we should really cherish, which are love and connection, which is the whole point of music at its core, rather than sort of, you know, this constant division and putting people into groups.
Yeah, I mean, when I read about what you're doing and people are hearing your thought process. We're recording this at a time when politics and divisiveness have now made it into professional sports with football.
Yes.
But you're talking about elitism in art. I mean, it's the same thing when people hear like what you just did with the Haydn Seven Last Words. You substitute the Seven Last Words of Christ and put in these last statements of these death row inmates from Texas. People think, well, that's kind of gimmicky, but that's not your point. The point is to make that piece of Haydn, which is, you know, 200 plus years old.
Relevant today.
So it can move somebody and not politicize it. There is music that can certainly be political, but like you say, make it relevant. Therefore, you can do that piece, and people who don't know a stitch of Haydn, have never heard a string quartet, have never heard a piece of classical music even, can be drawn into it.
Yes.
And I think the elitism, which you talk about, is that there are those who maybe don't want that public in. They want only the people who know and appreciate. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it's that kind of separation that you're trying to break down.
Well, definitely. I mean, I think when you look at the history of music also, it's very much before concerts were a regular thing during Bach's time, it was either in the church or for royal families.
Right.
They have patrons. You know, it's always been the rich paying for the musicians. And this continues today. I mean, look at the Met Orchestra. That's sustained by patrons, not ticket sales. And that's how classical music survives, is from patrons, and for which we are extremely grateful. But that also puts a very interesting shadow over what we do. And also, like, the start of the Industrial Revolution, when city centers became important, and bringing people where elements of wealth can be shown rather than just knowing these hierarchies that have existed in the past and new money. And so when you go to sort of cultural events, you can present the image of somebody who is cultured and knows money and all these kinds of things. And I think that's also around the same time when concerts began to become a thing, and the rise of Liszt and the rise of the sort of the virtuoso and all these things are all at the same time, and I don't think that's coincidence. So there are just certain trends that I think are undeniable, that also in this country, if you study classical music, you do that because your parents can afford lessons, not because you are somebody who has the talent and wants to. So unfortunately, we are put in this in a very sort of, you know, socioeconomic way, and it shouldn't be. And how can I, just as one person in the field, do something to fight that? And this is what I've come up with.
So on two fronts, how do you continue this? So we'll go back to the career. Do the recording first. How do you follow up something like the Bach? I mean, what do you want to follow this, whatever the fate of CDs are, since, you know, music.
But, let's not go there.
Well, or even just put it out there for downloads or for posterity. I mean, what's your thoughts on how do you keep putting things out there that people can hear your artistry but not have to, you know?
I just got a message from somebody who had listened to one of the pieces, the Andante from the A minor violin sonata, and he said that it helped him with the death of an in-law. And that was really touching, that if I can help somebody, that, I mean, I didn't do anything specifically for him, but if what I did can make his day a little better, that's awesome.
Yeah.
And I'm so fortunate to be a part of his life in that way. And where do I go from here? I want to play and continue to share music with whomever is willing to listen to it, to people that don't know that they want to listen to it yet, and to anybody that is interested in music. I love performing for people, and that's just the core of why I'm doing this. I mean, even when I didn't realize the power of music, I still loved performing. You know, it's something that I would wake up on concert days, even as a kid, just so excited that I got to be on stage to play for people, that all this practicing finally turned into something more than that. And so that is what I want to be doing for the rest of my time here, is, you know, playing for people, and hopefully by doing that, bringing them some solace from their day-to-day existence.
Do you see, I mean, when you present concerts to a different type of audience that might pay a prime ticket to go to Carnegie Hall or something like that, I mean, other groups are doing this too, non-traditional venues presenting quote-unquote classical music. I mean, do you see this, as you've gone expanding, do you see this being embraced and accepted a little bit more each year?
Accepted by whom?
Well, that it's not an unusual thing, that it's not something
I certainly hope so. I mean, as a musician, we're all just hustling to try to, you know, make ends meet. So it's just people don't have time to make the effort to do this. But for me, if I don't make the effort to do this, I don't want to do any of it. So
let's say word is out that you're going to play a concert at a mental health institution, a ward, and it's not like, oh, that's an odd place for you to play, but rather, oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Just
I think
music belongs there as much as it belongs in Carnegie.
Right. I think it's becoming a more common thing, that, you know, outreach, the idea of outreach.
Right.
And I hope it just continues to grow as much as possible.
Well, wish you the best of success with all that.
Thank you.
Like I said, I think your mindset is really not only healthy, but I think pervasive among a lot of artists in your age strata.
Right.
And that's really good. I mean,
I hope so.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah.
I close on my cadenza interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. The first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat, like we've been doing, with someone from the past, and you never had a chance to. When I ask that, what's the first name that pops into your head? Somebody you just love to talk to.
Joan of Arc.
I've actually, in 13 years, somebody else, I don't remember who picked Joan of Arc, but why are you, what's your... crazy.
For a woman to have that, to have be in that position at
right.
that time is pretty phenomenal.
But if you talk with her, you have to compete with the voices she heard as well.
That's
so it'd
true.
Be a three-way
That's
track.
That's true. That's fine. You know, I have some familiarity with mental health.
It's funny because you talk about Bach not playing. What a healing force.
Oh, I'd love to hang out with Bach.
Well, Bach is the number one
runaway
answer. He's the number one runaway answer. But Joan of Arc is interesting to us. Final question is non-musical, meaning you rattled off some things earlier that you did. Everybody interviewing Cadenza fills their life with music. When you have to clear yourself away from music, respite, relaxation, pleasure, enjoyment, but can sort of get a look just that little distance, what do you do? I mean, what you did caused problems. What do you do now?
Oh, this is a good question. I was kept on thinking recently, I need some hobbies, some new hobbies, because there's worse a time for that. I mean, I love food. I absolutely love food. I could, you know, eat all day and have it not be on my health. I mean, that's just another way of enjoying life through another sense.
You went back to music. Did you go back to the martial arts?
I did, but not with the same fearlessness.
Right.
There was always a fear, and it was never something comfortable again. So I just did it for the sort of the exercise element. I mean, I think it's important to, you know, to stay in shape and to be as healthy as possible, just to, you know, to feel better. So, I mean, I run. It's not terribly exciting, but I do it. I feel better after it. I wouldn't call it a hobby. But, no, I just think it's really interesting to meet people. The benefit of being a musician is that you get to travel a lot to different parts of the world, and not as a tourist. So when you get to meet people on a very basic level and stay in people's homes or meet people in the audience and be invited to things, it's just very nice to see all the different ways we can live our lives, different cultures.
And you've already shared something with them in your artistry.
Hopefully. Yeah. I've made them listen to me for a couple hours, whether they like it or not.
Well, thank you, Gabrielle. You're pleasure to take some time.
Thank you.
Pianist Tania Gabrielian. You can find out more about her at her website, Tania, T-A-N-Y-A, Gabrielian, GABRIELIAN.com. She is performing in our area this weekend with concerts at the Trenton Psychiatric Hospital tomorrow night, a NAMI conference workshop on Saturday, but you, the public, can attend her benefit concert for NAMI of Mercer County, NAMI being the National Alliance for Mental Health, this Sunday at 3 p.m. at the Pennington School, 112 West Delaware Avenue, Pennington, New Jersey. Her new CD, Remix Bach Transcriptions, which we've sampled from throughout this program, is on the MSR Classics label. Check it out at msrcd.com. I'll leave you with one more selection from that disc, Alexander Solotti's transcription of the Andante movement from Bach's Violin Sonata No. 2 in A minor, BWV 1003, performed by my guest today, Tania Gabrielian. And as always, I'm glad you're in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to wwfm.org and clicking on Classical and then Webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been the award-winning Cadenza, an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.